Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and we are back on the coronavirus coverage. It never ends, Martin. Never, ever, ever ends.
No. It's a rolling nightmare. Every morning you wake up, you go, yeah, it's still here.
Yeah, no, look, in fairness, I have to say it's been a strange situation over the Easter. I hope everybody had a reasonable time. You know, I know it was hard not to be able to spend time with friends and family that you usually do. But you know, it's for the greater good, and it does have to be said, the vast majority of people are complying with social distancing, and they are, you know, not taking the piss, and that's the main thing. We're not taking the piss. It's good to see. On the flip side, podcast wise, we are putting out trundles of content, guys. We've been really looking after in terms of, you know, great content out there at the moment. And two new pods went out earlier with Glow West, had Caroline's third podcast, which is with Adeline Berry, which is another, I can't even get the words out because I get all prudish. But anyway, and then Rachel is now Disturbing the Peace has gone 2 days a week for a few weeks now during the corona crisis. She's putting out two pods, and her most recent one now was with three Leaving Cert students and what they're going through and how they feel about this situation and what it means to them. You know what, tune in, maybe throw us the price for a cup of coffee as well. Anyway, enough housekeeping, straight into it now. Our guest today is probably at this stage is easily the person who's been most on the podcast since we started. CEO and co-founder of Inner City Helping Homeless and independent Dublin City Councillor, Anthony Flynn. Anthony, how are you?
Gentlemen, that's a very long title, that is, Tony, isn't it? Did you rehearse that before you got it out?
Yeah, you got it down nice, not too
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, just a one and one, Martin. Yeah,
I'll just say pal.
Yeah, all right, pal. Mate. Well, actually, just on that, how many times is this now? Would because I know Claire O'Connor was looking for
running total. I know. I'd say you're nearly double her now at this stage.
Yeah, definitely, you know, definitely.
I would have to say.
Have to go back through the memory bank and find out exactly though.
Listen, I saw, obviously, you guys are still seeing a lot of people sleeping out. You might want to give us, can you give our listeners an idea of what it's like with the work that Inner City Helping Homeless are doing right now in the middle of a global pandemic?
Well, I suppose just last night we've seen the highest number of people that have slept rough since Christmas, because normally, I suppose I'm the voice that's always given out, but I did welcome the fact that we saw a serious reduction in the number of people right up to the Christmas period and even into January, of people that were sleeping rough and people that were presenting as rough sleeping. We'd always have the argument in terms of the figures or the overall national figures, and you know how high they would be. But on the ground in Dublin, there was a reduction. Like, we went from 160 to 180 people down to below 80 at one stage, which was very, very positive. It was, things are happening here. And you know, when I see the likes of that, it brings joy to us, because, one, it reduces our workload, and two, it means people are coming in off the streets. And, you know, when we're out and we're saying that that's happening, that's the truth. You know, we're 80, 90 people. We went back up last night to 103 people that are sleeping rough. And I suppose over the last week, what we've seen is an increase in people that are presenting and looking for tents, people that are looking for sleeping bags. And I know, you know, we had got some independent some independent counsellors complaining about the fact that, you know, Anthony Flynn and his organisation are, giving people the means to sleep rough. But, you know, the people that are sleeping rough are basically sleeping rough because they have a serious issue in regard to the hostel accommodation that is being provided for them. And over the last 3 weeks, I've been very, very vocal, because I've visited some of these hostels, and one night I visited three of the hostels, and any chance of social or physical distancing within these facilities is just absolutely ridiculous. You know, from staff to those that are required to sleep there. We had a breakfast room or a tea room that must have had 40 or 50 people sitting in on one of the first nights. And, you know, this was the early days of when the pandemic and the crisis was announced. And, you know, a lot of things come into place very, very quickly. And, you know, there was a lot of movement and a lot of people working very, very hard in the background. And, you know, I'm consistently, I suppose, contradictive of what the DRHE rolls out and how they roll it out. And I always think we could be doing a better job. But, you know, very, very quickly, we saw some beds implemented and we saw people being brought in off the street. And then when we went in and looked at what was going on, it was just absolutely horrific. It was, you know, we 50 people on one day that were released through the Irish Prison Service. And they were released into homeless services. And, you know, I had an argument on RTE with John Lonergan about it and said, well, it's kind of ironic. And he's the former governor of Mountjoy. And it's ironic that we're releasing people from prison because of the COVID-19 pandemic, because there's overcrowding in the prison services. But yet what we're doing is we're moving them into a situation where there's further overcrowding and further people in these B&Bs or in these hostel style facilities. So, you know, you're moving from one kind of, you're moving from bad to worse, or, you know, straight into the frying pan, basically. And that has resulted now in us over the last number of days. And as I said, last night is the highest number. When I say highest number, 103 was never high for me, you know, it was 150 or 180 was. But we're starting to creep back up now over the last couple of days in regard to, and I don't believe we're catching everybody because we are on a reduced service. We haven't got those, you know, we wouldn't have the full outreach capacity that we have had because we've had to implement our own policies in regard to the number of people that we have on outreach. And we've only got the mobile units and we've had to increase the amount of mobile support units at night time. So what we're getting is basically those individuals that are presenting and looking for those tents and sleeping bags are saying that they're fearful and very, very fearful of sleeping in these hostel facilities with the COVID-19 pandemic and having to sleep less than a meter apart from, you know, four other people in the one room. So it really, you know, when you have people leaving the hostel system to run back out onto the streets, we've a serious problem.
Anthony, is there, you said in the early days there was a good bit of movement. Are there alternatives to the hostel system out there now at the moment?
We had offered, you know, the initial conversation that I had with the director of homeless services was to put in place, because we had a contingency plan and we activated our contingency plan from the time the initial measures were put in place. And that night at 9 or 10 o'clock, you know, we met with the board through Zoom and I met with the management team. And basically everything that we had planned was put in place that night. And one of the measures was the implementation of emergency accommodation for key working staff, for anybody that is vulnerable on the streets, that we had those systems ourselves. And we can only afford to do so much of that because obviously we haven't got the funding backing that many other organisations would have. But I suppose When I spoke to the director early in the initial days, we offered her the first 12 units that we had in place. And we said to her, look, these can be used. We can take, and their own door, own key facilities. We had the option of an apartment block to be taken over on the south side of Dublin. Costings were literally, you know, a quarter of what would normally have been paid through the normal process of homeless services. So, yeah, there is. There's definitely other processes. I've looked at some of the pricing and I heard only a couple of weeks ago, last week, that a question was asked at a council council meeting. It wasn't a full council meeting, but it was a case of around the pricing of some of the units that are being paid for. And we're not even getting any kind of leeway in terms, like they've went out and took, for instance, Day City apartments and they're paying them full whack for them. When there's, well, accommodation is to a penny now. You know, there's enough accommodation out there for you to go in and say, no, this is what you're getting. And the guys that are providing that accommodation will be happy enough to give it because they will be happy to get any kind of money. So, you know.
I find that because this is where, when we look at it in the current situation, rents are going to fall. Like, there's no fear. Everybody's going on and went about this rent freeze being extended. And, you know, and I'd like to see that now that rent freezes can come into place, that it can be done. But rents are falling because units have come onto the market. And despite what the government were saying, Airbnb was having a huge impact. And the likes of these staycation apartments and these other things, these villages, you know, these student villages that became places for weekend stag parties and that. Mm. But to find out that they're paying the going rate as opposed to, say, what a HAP payment would be or a percentage of a HAP scheme just doesn't seem to me make any financial sense. I mean,
some of the offers that have come in, like myself, I've received, I would say, upwards of 20 or 30 emails over the last last 3 weeks from providers in terms of the units, as you said, that would normally be used at these kind of holiday villages and SAGs and weekend parties and coming in and more or less begging you to take their units off them. Now, if I had the funding tomorrow, we would be out there and we would take them and we would ensure that this was put. And then, you know, look at, you know, I suppose a couple of weeks down the line or even a couple of months down the line when things settle down of what we can do in regard to actually taking these units over on a full-time basis and ensuring people have longevity in their accommodation. We should be taking everybody out of the hotels and everybody out of the B&Bs. All of the family should be gone, you know, and we should be sticking our fingers up at these hotel owners and B&B owners saying, no, you've wrote it, you know, you've wrote the cushy number here for a long time and you've done that for long enough. And you've made, like, when we look at the bill, the accommodation bill is €79 million, I think it was last year, with one provider receiving €4 million. And those providers not named because of their service level agreements, you know, that to me is just, I'm sorry, but if we're funding this, we should be told where that money is gone and who's providing it. And now it's time we go back to them and say to them, sorry guys, but we're just not willing. The market is ours to dictate now. And the only way that we do that is actually by coming out staunch and telling the providers, no, we're no longer willing to let you ride the wave that you've rode for long enough.
When you think back that the Taoiseach came out and spoke against profiteering, and yet here we have the government artificially propping up a market. You know, they are using state aid now to prop up an Airbnb market that no longer exists and will no longer exist into the future. As a model, it's finished. It's done. It's dusted. And yet they're propping up this market and keeping rents artificially high, when at the present moment in time, they could offer every landlord in the country half-half and they'd have to take their hand off for it. And definitely, they'd have to.
Yeah, because they would have no other option. Like, the amount of units that are lined out there empty. They've taken over so many hostels over the last couple of weeks, three in the last week that I know of that would fit up to 100 people in each. These were all private operators that would never, ever, ever have given you a bed for a homeless person before.
Can I come in and say on that now, and I, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard anecdotally that one of these hostels has been taken over by none other than one of the banks that are behind some of the biggest, what we would term, vulture funds.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Three of them have been, and three of them have been then have been given back to DCC at no reduced level. The people that are going into work in these facilities, the NGO sector has been basically told where to go, mind your own business. And we've got staff that are untrained, that haven't got the level of training required to deal with the people that would be staying within these facilities. Because when we do look at it, there's many, many people that are in homeless services have issues, whether it be addiction, whether it be mental health. You know, there's a number. And then there are many people that don't have any of those issues or any of those problems. But we've got to be realistic that there's a very high percentage of the people that we engage with do have that would be in the hostel system, not the family system, the actual physical, you know, when you're talking about people that are on one-night-only beds that were provided by the council. One of these units was taken over with 100. And I went down. There's security on it. People are getting searched going in. Your socks are searched when you're walking in the door. These people haven't got the training to provide the needs that these people require in order for them to come out the other side of homelessness. So what we're doing now is, again, as you said, Tony, propping up that system, number one. We're maintaining, if I've ever said this before, which I have, I don't know, you know, all of the time, maintaining and sustaining homelessness. Well, if we're ever doing it, we're doing it now, and we're going to continue. This is the best opportunity, you know, we shouldn't be using that word best, but this is our opportunity now to actually reshape society, to reshape how we deal with homeless services, and to implement proper procedures and plans in terms of how we get people to an end result of homelessness. And the only way that we're going to do that is by managing it correctly. What we're doing is firefighting. The people in the DRHE, although I have my arguments every day of the week with them, you know, some people are up there doing as many hours as our guys are down here, and you've got to give them a pat on the back for the work that they're doing. But they're following policy, they're following procedure, and they're doing exactly what they're told, instead of shaping the narrative themselves and saying this is something that actually can be tackled. And again, propping up that market of giving the banks, like when we offered them those units, before they even put a plan in place or had a plan announced, you know, we'll come back to you. That's exactly the words I was told. Oh, we will come back to you. Do you think I heard back? Do you think I even got a phone call to say that they didn't want them? No. But then they go out and they take three other major facilities from a major bank and continue, as you say, to prop up that market through the private sector.
Anthony, it's just out of fear of being overly negative, I have to come back and say there are huge improvements in some aspects when you consider, you know, when Owen Murphy used to famously say, if there's a bed for everybody, he often meant yoga mats on floors, you know. And he will tell you now that, you know, they've taken hotels in Temple Bar and they're putting people who are wandering the streets into their own room, and they're giving them a TV, you know, a bit of service, and it's a step up from that. And, you know, me and you, Martin, we've been talking about this kind of a housing first model and transitionary housing, you know, how you bring people into one system, then you move them on the front door, and you know, you can help them go through the conveyor belt of it and do it. So, yes, I abhor the fact that it's actually become a way for a vulture fund of all to start profiting again from human misery. But I also think that we have to say, yeah, that there are good. We're able to see that you know what, dignity starts at least with their own, with them having an actual bed and not a yoga mat.
In one aspect of it, you're correct, because the likes of Merchants Quay that had 75 people sleeping on those yoga mats every night has been closed and people have been moved into different facilities. They have kind of tried to reduce the number of people that are in these overcrowded hostels, but not to any great extent or any great levels. We have more units now, Tony, that are actually lying empty with nobody in them. So, but when they announced all these 350, and get the language correct, spaces, yeah. 350 spaces, okay, because this was Brendan Kenny's, first, I remember over a year ago when we talked about spaces, what are we talking about? They couldn't, it was fold down beds, it was mats, it was, you know, so okay, yes, we've taken all these spaces, many of them not identified to service level providers, many of them that are supposed to be in place or were supposed to be in place when the announcement came out 2 weeks ago, weren't. The announcement was made ahead of schedule. They hadn't taken over the facilities at the time. They have slowly started to move some of the people out of some of the units, but not at any great speed or any great level whatsoever. And then the bigger issue is then that the wraparound support services required to implement any kind of a housing force model are not in these facilities at all, because they haven't got the levels of staff support. And one of the biggest thing that we've actually done is taken over the provision of meal service. And, you know, they will tell you that people are being fed in these hostels 3 square meals a day. No, they're not. We're providing, only today before I come on here, I've sent 500 meals out of our office from microwaveable meals that would be provided to the hostel system, because the private operators that are supposed to be providing 3 square meals a day, in some cases are providing a breakfast, which might be a bowl of cereal and a slice of toast in the morning. In the evening, in one of the facilities, there's a pot. Every night for the last 2 weeks, there's been a pot of tomato soup put on, a big, massive pot. It was like the stew house. Please, sir, may I have some more, is what I'm told, within this facility, where you get a bowl of tomato soup at 7 o'clock in the evening, and you get 2 slices of bread with that. Now, you're supposed to be cocooning. You're supposed to be, you know, socially distanced, which is very hard to do within these facilities. You know, some of the facilities, some people can't get out to get, you know, and even if they do get out to get a meal of some sort, because Brother Kevin's and the Lighthouse are doing unbelievable work providing the hundreds of meals every day to those that can. Many haven't got the facilities to actually be able to cook those meals when they get them back. But every day, like at one stage last week, we were doing 1,200 between lunch and dinner packs. Then we went to 15. Then we went to just over 2,000 by the end of last week, every single day. Now, the DRHE will tell you that these providers are supposed to be providing these meals. They had up to 30 families in one hotel facility or B&B facility that hadn't got cooking facilities for the children and the adults that were in this. And the same owner had another hotel up the road which lay empty with nobody in it. And it took absolute uproar for us to actually get people moved from that hotel into the other hotel just so they could use the kitchen and feed children and ensure that the children were getting hot meals every day. So, just something that I've continued to say. The attitude that everything is rosy in the garden, we all know it's not, but it's not. It's nowhere near the level that they're trying to tell us it is. There are still systematic failures and systematic problems, and there always will be. We always know there will be, and not everything in life will be correct, and not everything in life will be rosy. But, you know, trying to cover up what we've continued to do for years here in terms of putting that plaster over the problem And that's what we're doing now. We're continuing to put that plaster. And we are going to see, we'll see the results of this in 3, 4, 5 months' time. And they're not going to be good. They're not going to be good at all.
From what you're saying, Anthony, have the NGOs been left outside the tent? This is now privateers, privatized, and there is an inside the tent group and there is an outside the tent group. Am I getting this situation correct?
Yeah, some of the NGOs have absolutely, like, for instance, you know, something that I've, and a shout out to all the guys as well that have come into us over the last couple of days. Somebody donated 5,000 bottles of sanitizer to us today. Someone, you know, we've the Shanghai community have come in, are coming in tomorrow, and that plane has landed, as far as I know. It's going through a dispatch now. There's 20,000 euros worth of personal protection gear. The NGOs are being left right outside the door. We didn't get a glove. We didn't get a bottle of sanitizer. We didn't get a face mask. And neither did many of the other partners that we work with. That would be, you know, government funded to a certain extent as well. But we hadn't been consulted. You know, we got an email in regard to the guidelines and policies and so forth. But, you know, we're working with people that are immunocompromised. We're working with people that would be highly susceptible to COVID-19. The hostel facilities, the same. And there was none of this put in place. What they've done is they've used one or two more bigger NGOs that would be, you know, that would be funded to a major level, like one of them 70 million euros from government last year. And they've kind of put them into a situation where, okay, you are responsible for this, but we couldn't get people registered last week. New presentations of people that were coming in that wouldn't normally use the system through these bigger NGOs that are supposed to be, like, you know, one of them that's supposed to be doing this work is funded to the tune of 6 million euros last year just for this project, yet they refuse to register people. So one or two of the NGOs, yes, they've got that, you know, bubble that they're in. But when you look at the work of Brother Kevin, and you look at the work of Aubrey over in the Lighthouse, and so many other people that are actually continued, we didn't close, Louise at Mendicity, didn't stop our day services, didn't close down, didn't reduce our hours, in fact, adapted and increased the level of service provision that we provide. And what happened? We got absolutely nothing from government or from the DRHE in regard to supports on how we move forward. And we're spending more money, and all of those organisations are, in order to fund the extra supports we put in place. But, you know, nobody's picked up the phone to say, well, look, you know, what do you need or where do you go from here?
Two questions, Anthony. First, when did you start preparing? And secondly, when did you first have a conversation with government about preparing, or a state source?
First conversation would have been with the Director of Homeless Services. And I suppose in terms of preparing, you know, we knew that there was something going to happen, but we weren't obviously on the inside track in regard to, you know, how bad. I think everybody, the whole country knew that, okay, look, this is a worldwide issue. And, you know, we had got warnings and heeded warnings from the World Health Organization and from, you know, it was a case that we knew it was going to hit, but when it was going to hit. And I suppose, you know, when the Italy game was cancelled and they still allowed all the flights into the country rather than, you know, saying, well, hang on a minute, the game is off. Why are we letting people in from, you know, an area that has basically been riddled with the COVID-19 virus? So, you know, we had in early February had major early discussions at our management level in terms of what do we do if this happens. And what, like, half of my management team are at home and working from home because of the fact that if or when I go down, you know, if I catch COVID or others that are working with us now at the moment do, we've got to have a whole complete new structure that can come in and manage at the same level that I can or others can that are working with us. So we had put that in place. And the first night that Leo made his announcements in regard to closures and stuff like that, you know, we went straight into a meeting through Zoom and through management and those procedures and policies and guidelines that we had already probably 2 months beforehand had ready to go were initiated. And at that stage, I would have spoken to Eileen Gleeson and said to Eileen Gleeson, look, we've got units here. We've got, you know, access to, you know, we're on the front line of what's going on. And you know, we can respond very, very well to this. And the offer wasn't taken up. But, you know, when we look around, there's not very many people still out and about. Obviously, people are following guidelines, which is great. But we've still got people that are very, very vulnerable and people that need assistance. And we've still got to ensure that the voluntary and the charitable sector is able to manage that appropriately and correctly.
Anthony, now, before we move on, because we are going to move on to a bigger question about one of your other roles, I want to remind listeners that they can donate, is it £4 if they text 50300?
50300.
And they have to just text outreach. Just a word outreach to 50300 to donate £4 to ICHH. If you want to give more, go to ICHH.ie. But just get that in there in the middle of the show, because quite often you bloody you all hang up in the last 20 seconds, folks. We get it in the middle. Listen, in terms of Dublin City Council, yeah, so you have a foot in two camps, really. You know, you're also an independent councillor in Dublin City Council.
On my scenes.
Yeah, well, I would agree, and before, but what we're seeing on a national level, in terms of, you know, the Dáil not sitting, people saying, look, we can't take questions, and then we saw the performative nonsense from a minister standing up and saying it was an outrage that people wanted to ask questions. Is it right in saying we're seeing that on a smaller scale at local level as well?
Oh, definitely. Don't contradict and don't ask a question, because if you do, you're the worst in the world. I'm sorry, but we're in the middle of a global health pandemic. So locally, for you to open your mouth or say anything or contradict the amazing job, and I put that in brackets or commas, that's being done, you know, you're vilified. And I'm sorry, but I just don't agree with that. There has to be a sense of, you know, people being answerable to, you know, the first electorate. You know, because we have a global health pandemic doesn't mean that either local government or national government goes out the window, because at any time it should be, you know, local government that are leading, national government that are leading in terms of how this response is managed. And, you know, local government has been annihilated, absolutely annihilated. It's not functioning. Nobody is, nobody's sitting. We did manage, because standing orders don't overrule or don't interfere with local area council. So local area council was able to meet. Christy Burke chaired that, and the 11 members last week were able to make some decisions at a very local level, on the ground. Mm. But council, full council is not sitting. There was arguments had 3 weeks ago about the April meeting hadn't went ahead, and the it does state that the meetings do have to go ahead, and decisions, a lot of decisions that need to be made can only be made with the council sitting. I think one of the, one of the things that we may see happen is probably the bigger parties looking to give the CEO more powers, and how they do that. And that's something that I would not be under any circumstances agreeable with. I think he's too many powers as it is. And, you know, local councils should not be suspended in any way, shape or form just because of the pandemic. If anything, we should be looking at new ways through the law agent, and through emergency legislation. We can rush, we've seen, we can rush as much legislation as we want, as quick as we want. So we've done it with the banks, you know, so it's not a case of us not being able to do that. Well, we understand that there is legislation that is needed in order for the council to sit and hold meetings online. But this is done in Europe. So, you know, we should be just going, copy, paste, and there you go. It's implemented, and allow the May meeting of Dublin City Council to go ahead. There was talk about just a certain number of people being allowed into the chamber. Well, again, I'm sorry, but I'm not agreeable with that either, because, you know, it's a case of I'm an independent councillor, and, I want to be able to have my representation made on behalf of the people that I, my constituency and the people of Dublin. There's a big, big problem locally, and it's being put on the long finger 3 weeks, because they thought at council level 3 weeks, we might get this sorted and we might be able to meet by May. I knew there's no way we're going to have May's meeting. So now we're in a situation where we've got two meetings that haven't, well, one meeting hasn't been held. The May meeting is due to be held. And I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know what, you know, my suggestion would be that we get the emergency legislation brought in through the minister. And it's Owen Murphy, actually, incidentally, that's responsible for that as well. Martin, you'll be happy to know.
The missing minister.
But look, you know, he can pass legislation to allow us to meet online. And there's a format there already. So
I think you're where you say there is great difficulty. Well, I don't see great difficulty. You've just explained how simple it is to take care of it. So there's not great difficulty in doing it. It can be done. 20 minutes. Could it be done in 20 minutes? Yeah, okay. So it can be done in 20 minutes. It's a snap of the fingers kind of thing. So it's not difficulty that is your problem. It's an unwillingness to have any democratic oversight on what's going on. That's the problem.
Oh, the only... Well, when we look at the council chamber on Dublin City Council, the majority is the Dublin Agreement parties, and that's majority made up of Fianna Fáil and the Greens. The unwillingness is definitely there. And again, when I look at it both sides and weigh it up, and I say to myself, well, you know, we've never been faced with this kind of situation before. But why hasn't there been something put in place that if we ever are faced with a situation that council cannot meet for whatever reason, that there is a system there that should have been planned and should have been put in place long before. So the unwillingness, I think, yes. And I think it's going to be very, very, there's going to be an awful lot of arguments over the next 2 weeks about what's going to happen and how this is going to function or how this is going to run.
I think even those ambitions, you know, stuff like going online or being prepared for stuff, even those ambitions are small. Half the country has time on its hands, and it really does have time on its hands. Well, we could constructively use that time to design a new constitution based on rights. We could do that.
Something else that that I suppose, and a lot of people or a lot of my fellow councillors won't be happy with this. Yes, lots of people have lots of time, but the councillors are still being paid and still getting expenses. And fact of the matter is that, yes, there is work to be done. There's constituency work. I'm answering my phone all the time, but I haven't travelled. I haven't, went and been, I haven't had to make my way to the chamber or to City Hall. So I think that's something as well that should have been reviewed, and right across the board from TDs all the way down, people are put on a €350 pandemic payment because they've lost their jobs. Yet we're still paying full salaries to TDs and councillors.
I wouldn't be going to say kick them and take their salaries, but I would be concerned about the guys who take every month. For example, as a TD, a sitting TD can take about £2,435 in unvouched. Expenses. Just travel and expenses allowances, and it's just wrapped in and sadly, the vast majority of them just opt for the exact same flat amount because then they don't have to go in and give any details.
I even think we should really avoid the small fry just now. Mm. I think there's much bigger money other places that needs more scrutiny.
Yeah, I think after the pandemic, that when we look back on what we're spending, I suppose the warning has already been there with the Taoiseach to say, we'll all have to tighten our belts conversation had over a week ago, and that the hard decisions will have to be made. And, it's really when the bills do start coming in from this to see who's got what and where it's went. And we're going to be having the exact same conversations we did right through the recession period. And, I think there's going to be an awful lot of people are going to have to come back and say, hang on a second, this is just... the small
looters in a riot, and that was what I'm reminded of. And the looters, unfortunately, again, are wearing suits, shirts, and ties.
You're dead right, Tony. You're dead. That is a great analogy. That is an absolutely great analogy. The looting is going on at the moment. Brilliant analogy, Tony. Brilliant.
I think after it, though, the assessment of what even with the PPE and the stuff like that, the money we're spending on stuff, and I listened to the news summary this morning from the HSE, and, people that were thanked for, donating X, Y, and Z, and fair play to everybody that is. I can't thank people enough that are doing stuff. But then there's others that are out there that didn't even get a look in regard to playing full of gear that came into the country, because it's always this whole pat on the back attitude that I've always said is there. In our state, politics has always been there and it always will be there, And it's only those that are in the suits that will get the pat on the back, unfortunately.
Yeah, the inside-outside tent thing is very worrying for a society that's meant to be all in it together. It is very worrying.
I'm going to be more optimistic about this. People can't unsee that we can do these things really quickly. People, like they're saying 11 million. Is it 11 million a month we're paying to private hospitals at the moment?
Yeah.
How long? I think now, again, I could be wrong on that. I want to be clear on that. That was just a figure that I've seen bandied about. If we're wrong on that, so what? It doesn't matter. We need to look up when we bring these things into public ownership, as opposed to, sweetheart deals for emergency situations. And we need to look at those, as Martin said, Airbnb is gone for the foreseeable future. And the foreseeable future is not 6 months, it's not 12 months. It's a long to medium, it's a medium to long-term thing, at least. You know, we don't know until these things, until the whole globe is vaccinated.
When exactly.
So you can't have, so all of these things need to come into sway. And I do think the democratic oversight, the idea of asking questions now does not mean that you're not pulling on the green jersey, because that's become toxic now. You know, the idea of asking these things is toxic. Last thing, Anthony, is just going back to where we started. You guys are handing out meals. You're going out. You're doing outreach on the streets still at night. There's still a sizable amount of people who choose to decide it's safer to sleep on the streets than it is currently to go into this accommodation. Calls on the public. How are you finding fundraising at the moment? Because it can't be easy in this environment. I know we're finding it very hard to keep this going. So
I think look, people have been amazing. Like, you know, like I got a bill the other day for £600 for hand sanitizer. And, you know, like I'm looking at stuff that comes in, and you know, normally you've Esther and you've Anne here and you've Brian here and you've people. So like a lot of the stuff I don't see because they manage it, and now I'm looking and saying, Jesus, £600 for hand. But I put a call out on Twitter, you know, and within the space of a couple of hours, we had we Girl Base or something, and we'd UCD onto us, and you know, they'd supply us from Tuesday, and we had someone else come in today with 5,000 bottles of hand sanitizer, and you know, and then obviously the Shanghai community came in with personal protection, because all of that costs a hell of a lot of money. But just talking at a manager meeting last week, and we were looking at what we would be in terms of fundraising, because look, as you know, we don't operate without our supporters and our donors, because we don't get government funding. You know, we do about 5,000 food parcels delivered to elderly people and people living in hotels and B&Bs. You know, it's the increase in service level has been unbelievable. And then all of a sudden, then you've no charity football game that was supposed to go ahead. You know, you've no music night on, or you've, you know, and we're talking about how much we'd be down, and you know, it was a case of anything, but like you couldn't put a figure, but anything between 60,000 and 80,000 over 2 months, that we would be down in fundraising activity, and you know, I'm saying to myself, well, Jesus, how are we going to manage that? Like, you know, but yeah, I think people have been very good, though. You know, we've seen some online stuff that has come in over the last few weeks, you know, the text donate number, again, people have been coming on board, and like a lot of people have been let go from jobs. A lot of people, you know, are claiming the pandemic employment thing, but yet still people are coming in with stuff. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's 5,000 bottles of hand sanitizer. If it's, we don't have to pay for it. It's marvelous. Like, you know, we take the stuff. But I think, you know, overall, we're not going to see our fundraising activities go back to normal until probably September or August. And then you're already into the Christmas period and you're planning for that. So, you know, it's day by day. And, you know, we've got some amazing people that have come in with, you know, someone was providing us with the lunch packs, you know, in order for us to get those sandwiches out to people. You know, Fish Foods came in with the meals. You know, there was up to 500 of them went out today. And people, you know, so that's kind of that physical stock response that has been put on the ground. Like when you looked at the Easter egg, you know, 6,000 Easter eggs they've given out in less than 4 days. You know,
none left on my driveway, mate.
I have one for you.
You are the Easter. You simply are the Easter bunny this year.
He was disgusted because there was none outside his door. I get Dermot to drive.
It was such a lovely gesture.
It was, the guys that come in, Martin, with that was, you know, and even the response of the people that wanted to come in to give us a house or give us a hand and distribute that was great. But then, like, I went in yesterday and had a look, and there was like nothing left. And I was saying, where did they all go? Like hotels, B&Bs, direct provision. You know, they drove the length and breadth to try and get to as many people as they could. And that donation was absolutely fabulous. But then other stuff that's coming in as well, you know, people with pallet of water here, everything makes a difference. And like, we end up with nothing on the floor in the warehouse, and I look at it and say to myself, shit, what are we going to do tomorrow?
And then somebody comes in and
I come in the next day, or Dandy is on the phone, he's saying, we've just got this, or Brian is saying, so the community response is fabulous, and the people that are out there that have looked after us over the last 2 weeks, like, we can't thank them enough. We could not do what we do without that response and without those people. You know, well, it's amazing what
it's a credit to the guys that keep the show on the road. It's a credit to yourself and the team. We want to say thank you. Like, you know, I barely even mentioned the fact that I'm doing a fundraiser this year for you guys in terms of running. Still knocking out the miles every day, by the way. But look, you know, if you have the phone in your hand and you're listening to this, 50300 text the word outreach. It's £4. You know, this is what we need to be doing. You know, we're all in this together, and we genuinely believe we're all in this together. Let's not go the other way with this. Anthony Flynn, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Buddy, well, take care of yourself and stay safe. Yeah.
Thank you. We'll get them Easter eggs up to you tomorrow, Tom.
I'll just drop me up a couple of bottles of something, Anthony. Anthony, have
Lilt.
Oh, bother.